Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. You're about to meet British performance maker and citizen of the world, Catherine Hamilton, founder and director of the New York-based company Sister Sylvester. Catherine uses theater as a platform to address social issues. An example, her staging of Jean Genet's The Maids. In its review, Time Out New York wrote, "Director Catherine Hamilton uses The Maids as a springboard into the most unstylish thing imaginable, the real world." The company's latest production, They Are Gone, But Here I Must Remain, examines the relationship between art and rebellions. She's also a member of Kuşe, an art space in Istanbul, Turkey, and she divides her time living half the year in New York, half the year in Turkey. Catherine's father was in the military, so she spent a good part of her childhood overseas. She speaks several languages, returning home to attend Cambridge University. She moved to the States and received an MFA in theater direction from Columbia University. After graduating, Catherine spent a couple of years working for the French Embassy in Manhattan, but she left to pursue theater full-time. Catherine's also the recipient of numerous grants and has been a resident at Salem Artworks, San Sebastian European City of Culture, Park Avenue Armory, and Spread Art Detroit, among others. Catherine, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
What's your passion, Catherine?
Making performances about things that I'm passionate about in the world.
Yeah. So what are your passions?
Well, the thing, certainly the work that I've been making recently in New York has been considering the power divides here. I'm really interested in using performance to kind of try to understand the way that power works within a city, within a community, within a society.
Class struggles?
Definitely. And just the ways that the kind of fault lines of power that we don't necessarily notice within our daily lives, but that we exist in amongst. I think performance is a really powerful tool for kind of trying to make those things visible.
Did you notice that more here when you moved to the States?
I did, just because I was an outsider, because it was a place I was coming to that I didn't know already. So I wasn't used to the ways that things were working.
Like they might have been in Great Britain, for
right,
example.
Exactly. If you grow up with certain,
conventions,
yeah, then you don't notice them so much. When you go to a new place, mm-hmm. things become really evident to you that might not otherwise have been.
How did you come into theater? Did you always know that you wanted to, perform or direct or?
No, not at all. I used to really want to be a writer. That was my first kind of passion, I guess. And then performance became a way to, performance I became more and more interested in through my college years, because it was a way to take, you've got so many kind of strands that you're working with, and you can get them to work in opposition against each other. So you have the words, but you also have what people are seeing, and you have what people are hearing and experiencing, and those things can cut against each other mm-hmm. in ways that I find really interesting.
Because that writing can't in the same sense.
Well, I certainly couldn't in writing. I think really good writers can.
Okay, good point.
Uh-huh. And so for me, it became a way to have kind of multiple truths cutting against each other simultaneously. And I found that really interesting, because the audience are then left in a kind of moral quandary rather than with a decision.
But how did you know you could do that? How did you know you were capable of doing that?
I think I just started. College, when I was an undergraduate, there were a lot of opportunities to. There was no theater program, but there was a lot of opportunities to make work, to work with other people. So I spent a lot of time in the theater department when I was in college, and gradually figured out that that was. Well, gradually became excited about that rather mm-hmm. than about just writing.
And did you feel that you were understood?
What do you mean?
Well, that what it was that was driving you, what it was that you wanted to get out or to share, you felt at home in the theater department at Cambridge? Or did you feel maybe a little outsider-ish? Because do unorthodox art.
Right. And I think at the time, I mean, when I was there, I was performing in a lot of other people's work, because I really didn't know what it meant to be a director. Like, I didn't know how to direct. I didn't know how to make work from scratch. I really had no idea about it. So I ended up acting in a lot of other people's pieces, not because I wanted to be an actor. I had no interest in that, but I wanted to learn how they did it. So, I mean, it's interesting. Like, as you make more pieces and you work more, obviously your craft, you just get better at your craft.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly you start to be able to to take the things that you're imagining and turn them into something that might be somehow comprehensible to other people.
I understand.
It takes a long time. Mm-hmm. So I think certainly when I was there and starting out, the few things that I did direct when I was at Cambridge, I don't think that they, I just didn't have the skill set yet to try and bring to life the things that I was imagining.
But you didn't give up?
No.
Why?
Because when you fail, it makes you frustrated and you want to try again. I think that's it.
Well, that's a good way to live.
Yeah.
So take us through that. So you get involved in theater at Cambridge and you kind of feel that there's this drive inside of you. And then you finish school. Mm-hmm. Why'd you come here?
Because I got into the directing program at Columbia.
So you knew that that was something that you wanted to do while you were still in Great Britain.
So I left Cambridge and I still hadn't, I mean, I don't come from a family with, like, no one was in the arts. I didn't really have a way to imagine that as a possible career path. And so it took me a while to get the confidence to admit that that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I thought for a while about going into academia. That seemed like a much more sensible option. It still does.
A safer option.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when I left Cambridge, I was actually part of a touring company, and we went to Nepal and North India touring with a show, and we were doing a lot of teaching, like workshops and things, and touring this piece we'd made. And then I went down to the rest of the company went back to England, and I wasn't really sure what I was doing with myself, so I decided to stay. I managed to find a job in the south working with a traditional theater company, and stayed there for a while, and they were wonderful. I mean, they gave me so much space and freedom. It was a very traditional theatre company, but where kids would come in at a really young age and kind of apprentice the whole way through and learn these all-night theatre pieces. They'd learn all the parts to these all-night theatre pieces. Mm-hmm. It was a really incredible place, but the people who ran it were just lovely, and they gave me this kind of time and space to work with the kids there, teach them some English, and also kind of like play around with some different like ideas, directing things with them. And I think that, in a lot of ways, gave me the confidence then to apply for Columbia and then stay.
But I read about you that because your father was in the military and you did a lot of traveling,
right. It
was not a big deal for you. You were comfortable, I guess, in your own skin, being out of your element, whatever that may have been.
Well, I think it's in my element because we moved so frequently. We moved every 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So we were on the move a lot, so it feels much more comfortable. Actually, when I got here... I remember Anne Bogart, my teacher at Columbia, challenging me to try and stay somewhere for at least 5 years. I did that. I've been here for 5 years now. And now I've found a really great balance, I think, splitting my time between two places.
Two very different places.
Yeah, although Istanbul and New York, they have a lot of the same energy. Like, the cities are the big, bustling cities, you know, with a lot going on and really great art and culture. And more similarities than... Differences.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is British performance maker and director Catherine Hamilton. First, before we get into Sister Sylvester, which is a really interesting story, well, wait a minute. Did that come before Coucher?
Yes.
So then how did you come to form a theatrical company? And what does the name mean?
Okay, yeah, that's a good
Because you don't have a sister named Sylvester.
No, I do not have a sister named Sylvester. The company formed when I was still at Columbia, and it was myself and a colleague who was a playwright and a group of actors, and we'd all been working together a lot while we were there.
What year was that, just to get a sense of time?
2010, maybe?
Okay.
Yeah, 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. We started, and we'd been working together a lot on different projects, and we started because we got this great opportunity to go to upstate New York to this amazing place called Salem Artworks, which is a residency center right in, like, almost in Vermont, like top of upstate New York. It's an ex-dairy farm with just like acres and acres and acres of land and old barns, and you can weld things and choreograph tractors. And it's an amazing place. We were there last year as well, and we built our set and then smashed the entire set with tractors at the end of the show, which is something you can't do in either New York or Istanbul.
I would think not.
Yeah. But so we got this opportunity to go up there, and I was going to direct The Screens, which is another Genet play. It's a 5.5-hour play with 30 actors, over 100 characters. It's a crazy piece. And we staged it all across this farm. So you moved around the farm as the piece progressed.
That's a hell of an undertaking.
Yeah, it was, It was a big project. It was great fun, though, a really amazing group of people. But so we went up there and we needed to form a company to fundraise. So initially it was just called the Screens Project. And then we got back and, you know, this group of people just kept working together. And so we formed Sister Sylvester. And the name comes from the fact that when we were back in New York, a very nice priest named Father Jim gave us a room in an old school that had, in Greenpoint, there was a convent.
In
and
Brooklyn?
A school, right. A convent and a school that had all the nuns had left the convent. It was empty now. The school, because of changes in the neighborhood and new school districting, had shut down. So there was these two big empty buildings. And it was just when the crash had happened. So the Catholic Church had been hoping to sell them and no one was buying. So the priest decided to open them up to local art groups. And we were really lucky. And he gave us a room in the school and let us use the convent whenever we wanted. And we were staging...
For a fee?
For a donation.
Okay.
Yeah. And he did a kind of sliding scale. You know, big film groups would come in and pay good money. And then for people like us who couldn't really afford it, just be a donation to the church. So yeah, this was, again, like a really amazing opportunity to have some space to try and figure things out. When you're starting, you really need that without the pressure of kind of like, you know, a show at this time, you know, just space to work things out. So we were creating a piece called Play America in the convent. And all the actors would freak out when they were in this top room. And I was sitting out on the stoop outside the convent and Father Jim came by and asked how everything was going. And I said, oh, it's great, except that all the actors are terrified of that top room, of the top floor. And he went, oh, wait, the room at the back on the side? I was like, yeah, that one, they won't go in there. He said, oh, that's Sister Sylvester's old room. She haunts the convent. Apparently, she had died when a piano fell on her. She was the music teacher. She died when a piano fell on her, and she still haunts the convent.
And your company members just got creeped out on their own?
They got creeped out. Yeah, totally.
Unbeknownst to them.
We had no
idea. What her demise was.
We had no idea.
Oh, that's
yeah.
really crazy.
Yeah. So, and then we kept working there, and I remember one summer we were working there. We had all the doors open because it was so hot. People from the neighborhood kept coming in, and they'd say, oh, I remember. I used to go to school in that school. The nuns, what's happened to this place? Where are all the nuns? And we'd say, you know, it's shut down.
That's
now.
A good question.
Where are all the nuns? Uh-huh. I think they kind of ran out of nuns.
Yeah. Right.
Not so many anymore.
Right.
And a lot of them would say, oh, I remember. We'd tell them the name of the company. We'd named ourselves after Sister Sylvester at that point. And they say, oh, I remember Sister Sylvester. She was the best teacher. She had very good teeth and very red cheeks. And there were rumors of drinking beer in the basement. I'm not sure if it's true. So we that space was really a home for a while. And we were looking for a name for the company and the idea of...
So you kept her alive.
This ghost nun. Yeah, and I like it as well because I like mm-hmm. the kind of feminism of the mm-hmm. Sister Sylvester. I like that it kind of sounds like an 80s disco band. yeah, so...
And you performed, in addition to rehearsing there, you also held your performances there.
Right.
So people would come and see your shows.
Yeah, and we do site-specific pieces in the convent. We'd take over all five floors of it, and it would be a kind of, you know, people would arrive and it would the piece would move all around the space. It would become a kind of a performance party.
So you were really out there, weren't you?
It was
you were
really,
doing
it was
things that other
fun.
People weren't doing.
I mean, there's a lot of people are doing those kind of site-specific things.
But funky in the same way you were?
I enjoyed us. We always had a good party.
Were you financially successful?
No.
No. So it was tough to kind of make.
Yeah, really tough, which is why I started working, which is why I kind of took a two-year break and started working for the French Embassy.
You needed to make some bucks.
Yeah, also it just gets exhausting, like trying to self-produce pieces.
Well, a lot of people in the arts also have day jobs.
Right.
You know,
right.
You might be an aspiring painter and still working as a barista
sure.
at a Starbucks.
Yeah.
So that put some dollars in an account for you.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and you were able to marry the two? I mean, when you were working for the embassy, were you also still, I'm going to say, dabbling at that point in the theater, meaning that it wasn't full time?
Yeah, I mean, I was still directing, but it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to do a full, and the embassy was a full-time job. You know, you're expected to be there evenings, and
mm-hmm.
It was very much, it was a full-time job. And it was fascinating, and I learned a lot there, but I was trying to direct at the same time. And I just wasn't making good work. I was making bad work because I didn't have the headspace. You know, even if you have the hours that you leave work at 7 And then you can get to rehearsal by 8 and you can rehearse from 8 till midnight. But your brain is fried, you know? So you don't make good work. Or I didn't. Anyway, some people can do it. Some people can juggle like really intense full-time day jobs and their art career. But I was making bad work. And I realized I was making bad work. It's not fun to do that.
Well, it's also something you're not proud of. Yeah, and it just almost seems like such an exercise in futility.
Right. And it's so frustrating because you end up doing neither thing well.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So you leave the French behind.
Right.
And now you are doing your art full time.
Right.
How is that possible?
Well, I am getting more successful, I hope. But I do a lot of teaching as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I take other jobs from time to time, but I try to when I'm working on a piece. What I learned really from the embassy was that if I'm working on a piece, I need to be working on a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can, in between pieces, be working on other things and doing research for the next piece. But when I'm in rehearsal, I can't be doing another job. So what I try to do is find a balance of going between the two things.
So before we talk about Turkey, let's talk about this balance and also some of the productions that you've staged. Let's discuss The Maids and your really interesting take. He wrote the play in 1947, so that's quite a while ago. And you are contrasting it with modern day life. Talk about what provoked you to make this twist.
Well, I mean, I love Genet. Genet is my favorite playwright. I don't usually work with playwrights. I usually work on pieces that I create with the company. But Genet, I really, he's my hero.
Speaks to you, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with The Maids, I'd been... Since I left the embassy, and once I left the embassy, I started doing cat sitting and dog sitting in order to make ends meet and not pay rent, because it's a lot easier to survive in New York if you take that out of the equation. So I was cat sitting and dog sitting and house sitting, and I have a really kind friend who, when I'm between places to cat sit and dog sit and house sit, lets me stay on his sofa. And he has a very, very beautiful apartment in Tribeca. So I was staying with him, and I got to know the woman who comes to clean his house, Lau, who's from Brazil. And we kind of became friends. We'd hang out and chat.
And you speak and other languages.
I do. My Portuguese is not... I don't really speak Portuguese. My family lives in Portugal. And
currently?
Yeah. My mum's side of the family all live there.
Uh-huh.
So we have a lot of... That was because we would move so much when I was a kid, that would always be home. That was where we'd go back to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Lau and I kind of bonded over that and became friends. And I was walking back to the apartment one day, and she was in the apartment next door. And she sticks her head out from behind the door and says, Catherine, come here, come here. The owners are out. I was like, okay. She said, you have to see this apartment. It's insane. So we went in and she showed me around. And this apartment was just like, it's crazy. They'd knocked kind of two or three apartments into one. And it was so extravagant. So Lau's showing me around and she pours us two glasses of water. And she says, let's sit on the sofa and pretend we're rich and we live here. So we sit back on the sofa like, cheersing our glasses of water, pretending that this is our apartment.
Two ladies who are lunching
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We pretended we were two ladies lunching. And as we did that, I realized that it's basically a scene from Genet's The Maids, because it's in that play, they kind of ritually dress up as the mistress and you know, swan around and pretend the apartment is theirs. And so I told Lau this. I was like, oh, and she'd not read the play. And so the next time I saw her, I gave her a copy of the script. She didn't read it. She said it was very boring, but she loved the idea of making a play. And I knew that she sang in a choir. I knew that she, you know, she had that kind of performance experience, and she was a musician. She came from a family of musicians.
So she wouldn't be shy.
So we talked about it, and she cast herself and two other housekeepers, and I cast three actors, and then we brought them together and just started to read bits of the script, talk about the plots, talk about their experiences, and kind of we used Genet's central device, which is this idea of ritual enactment, to act out each other's stories and then to create a piece based on this intersection of the play and their own life experiences.
So basically, your version of The Maids was your version of The Maids.
Right.
That it was not really using his dialogue.
We had scenes where we'd use it. The beginning and the end were his dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle, we'd riff off of his dialogue. And there were some scenes. The play was in three languages because two of the housekeepers were Portuguese speakers and one was a Spanish speaker. And we had a cast where no one spoke, like one person, I think, who spoke all the languages. So there were a lot of people who couldn't speak to each other directly in the cars, which made directing interesting.
I bet.
But the intention was that you could come and see the show, and if you only spoke Spanish, you only spoke Portuguese, or you only spoke English, you would be able to follow the whole thing.
So that must have been a very nice review for you from Time Out New York, as well as from other reviews.
Yeah.
And was that sort of your first seminal production?
We did one production that got reviewed before that, but it got the worst reviews you can imagine. So this was the first one where we got some positive reviews. Yeah, mm-hmm. But well, I mean, I don't always agree with the reviewers anyway, so it's great to be engaged in that dialogue with them. And it's interesting to hear what they say, but if they're not mad about it, it's not the end.
Well,
of the world.
You're not going to kill yourself, you know. Again, if you're just joining us, my guest today is British performance maker and director Catherine Hamilton. So let's just move from Manhattan for a second all the way over to Istanbul. Mm-hmm. How did that part of the country, well, the world,
right,
become part of your world?
Well, my really close friend at Columbia was a Turkish director named Onur. And he'd stayed in New York after Columbia for a few years and then had eventually gone back to Istanbul. And we'd kept in touch. And he invited me over a couple of years ago now to make a piece with his company based on video they'd shot during the Gezi protests. Two and a half, three years ago, there were the big protests in Taksim Square and the kind of occupation of Taksim Square and Gezi Park. And so Onur and his company had been videoing. They'd been videoing themselves at the protests. One of the symbols of the protest became people taking books and standing in front of policemen reading the books to them, because the prime minister at the time, Erdogan, had said that this was just a bunch of, the rioters and rabble. And mm-hmm. so they kind of responded to that by taking their books. So Onur filmed members of his company reading during the protest as well, mm-hmm. reading from Julius Caesar. And so he had all of this material, all of these videos, and invited me over to work with the company and him on creating a performance out of these videos. So I went over there for that to start with, thinking I would just go for 3 weeks, make this piece with them, and that would be that. But I completely and utterly fell in love with it when I was there. Then had work back in New York, so I came back to New York where I was doing The Maids.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I could, I went back, and now I have my residency there. And I'm splitting my time about 6 months.
And it works for you.
It's great. I love it. It's a really good balance of places. And yeah.
Now talk to me about this latest production, which is They Are Gone, But Here I Must Remain. Another labor of love for you.
Right.
So
yes.
Explain what that's about, right, and the genesis of this performance.
Right. So this piece began about, I guess, 4 years ago now. It was while I was at the embassy. I went to a lecture by a French film theorist called Nicole Brunez at CUNY, and she was talking
about... That's the City University of New York.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about... she specializes in internationalist films, a kind of activist film. And she was talking about how a film can cause change in the world. And she said that it can do two things. It can be like a rocket shot from the future back into the past, or it can be a time bomb buried in the present waiting to explode.
Mm.
And her example of the first one, the rocket, was Jean-Luc Godard's La Chinoise.
The Chinese.
Yeah, which famously inspired or anticipated the... It was shot in 67 and anticipated this May 68 happenings in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really famous example of a piece of art that has either kind of predicted or caused in some way or inspired social action. And then her example of the second was a film I'd never heard of called The Fool by a British director named Peter Whitehead. And Nicole told us at this lecture that The Fool had not received distribution when it was shot. It was shot in New York in 1968. It was too violent, so Peter Whitehead's distributors refused to distribute.
The world was in turmoil then, particularly
right.
in the States.
Particularly in New York,
Chicago
right.
as well,
mm-hmm. right.
SDS, everything.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. he documented the SDS uprising or strike and occupation at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was down the road at NYU.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, and it's a beautiful film, but Nicole told me that it never received distribution, but 6 years later it was screened in Athens, Greece, at the Polytechnic, and the students watching the film were screened in secret at the Polytechnic, And the students watching the film were inspired by what they saw, especially the students at Columbia, to occupy their university, which became the pivotal event, like the catalyst for the overthrow of the military junta and the restoration of democracy to Greece. So I heard this story at CUNY in this lecture, and I was fascinated. So I wrote to Nicole Brunez afterwards, and she put me in contact with Peter Whitehead, the director. He sent me a copy of the film.
And this film is already 40-something years old.
Right, when you're, 47 years old, yeah. And so he sent me a copy of the film, and we started corresponding. And yeah, and initially I wanted to write about the piece. I wanted to write an article about it. And so I started, when I went back to England, I went to visit Peter. We'd hang out. I'd go up to his house and we'd hang out and drink wine and chat about films. And this correspondence carried on over the last 4 years. And I realized that it's not an article because a lot of the facts are not verifiable. It's so it makes a lot more, it makes for the material is more interesting as performance.
Lends itself to that better.
Because it's about uncertainty and kind of unknowability rather than hard fact and journalistic kind of investigation.
But, and so you're marrying the two.
Right. So now, so this piece will be a kind of performative lecture, a performance lecture. It starts as a lecture, as if there's someone just telling you about this film, and it kind of slides into other realms as it goes. And I'm working with two really wonderful performers on it, both of whom are primarily other things. Like one's a performance artist, and the other is a video editor. And with the two of them, again, we're kind of taking our own experiences and finding the points of intersection between them and this story, and creating the piece from that.
Do you ever stop and look back at who you are and what you've done, and that you've basically done it by yourself, and that you kind of think, wow, I can't believe what I've accomplished?
No, usually I look
forward. Because you're young. Let me just know, okay. How old are you?
31.
Yeah, that's not old. But how rich your life has been and what you have done in these years? Do you marvel at that, or you just don't think twice about it?
I know. I appreciate that I'm incredibly lucky to have the opportunities I have and to have traveled as widely and to get, like, mostly just to get to do the thing that I love doing every day. And to, you know, the difference between now and when I was working at the embassy is now I feel like I'm getting better. And that's such a satisfying, well, touch wood. Is there any wood here? Yeah.
There is wood. Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really exciting to start to be better at the thing that you do.
What do you want to do that you haven't done?
Just in kind of the near future, I want to continue with this, the idea that I started in The Maids, and do a trilogy of Genet plays, because they are such a good lens through which to view kind of power and the
life.
City. Right. Mm-hmm. And so next year, I'm going to be working on The Balcony with sex workers. And then the following year, Death Watch with people who've been through the criminal justice system.
Wow, that's a heavy-duty topic.
Right. Right.
Do you take your works on the road?
I'd love to. No, not really. That's something that I would love to do, that I dream of doing. Making pieces is, we were always in a kind of time crunch and a money crunch.
Right.
So by the time you put a piece up, you feel, and we make a lot of work. We did six new pieces last year, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. So by the time you put a piece up, you feel like it's a first draft. So I think
always a work in progress in
right,
a way.
But I think now I'm starting to get the opportunities, like hopefully we have an opportunity to do The Maids again, and starting to have these opportunities to take the pieces and finish them, which would be really exciting. And then I guess the next step from that is getting to tour them and getting to take them to wider audiences and see how different people respond to them.
So if I were to ask you, Catherine Hamilton, do you feel that you're in a good place? Your answer to me would be?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Better than 2 years ago.
Well, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Our time together is up, but I want to say that I thought that this half hour just flew by. And I'm just thrilled to have been able to meet you and have a conversation with you.
Well, thanks so much for having me here.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.